It's Tuned to Yesterday with an hour of collection curios. I'm your host, Mark LeVonier. The old-time radio collection at WRVO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape, and there's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's golden age, but among the shelves are series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, or at the very least, on the air in a very long time. Coming up later in this hour, an episode from the Tales from the Diamond K series with Western movie star Ken Maynard. But first, a program from the back of the shelf in more ways than one. It's an audition of a radio talk show with Bill Williams. Not to be mistaken with the actor of the same name, who was best known for his leading role on the early 1950s Western TV show The Adventures of Kit Carson. He was very much his own man and a known voice on New York City radio station WNEW as the host of many remote band performances and a staff announcer in the 40s. Being steeped in the music scene of the era in New York, he would end up making friends with many of the big band luminaries and crooners of the day, including Frank Sinatra, who owed him thanks for adding to his roster of nicknames by dubbing him Chairman of the Board. And because he adored Sinatra's talent, he continued to spin his records on the air, even as tastes were changing, helping to keep Sinatra's voice and career alive. Bill Williams was let go from WNEW in 1947, and before being rehired in 1953 and settling into that station for what would be a four-decade-long tenure as a disc jockey and host, he tried his hand out west for about a year. And next is the audio that survives from his attempt at a mix of comedy and conversation. Here now, the audition for what would never become the Bill Williams Show, recorded for consideration on August 15, 1951, on CBS radio affiliate KNX.
Good afternoon, which is probably as clever an ad-lib as you're going to get out of me all day. Welcome to the Bill Williams Show. This is where you're supposed... Thank you. I must confess that I signal for the applause because looking at it pretty dispassionately, when a guy gets on the air and says, good afternoon, this is the Bill Williams Show, how cleverly can you say good afternoon? That is a matter of fact, how cleverly can you say Bill Williams? My name is Bill Williams, which isn't particularly exciting news, but a guy has to have a moniker, and that's mine. This rather capricious clam bake we're about to indulge in is a program that we're throwing together, and I use those words advisedly. In the afternoon at KNX, I am, you should pardon the expression, a recent import from New York City, so that some of these call letters of the stations out here are completely foreign and alien to me. Back east, which an expression I'm sure you've heard too much of. Back east, all the stations start with W, and out here they all start with K. So if at times I lapse into a W or a liquid L, your forgiveness, please. The show itself is supposedly spontaneous. I don't know what that means, but you must admit it adds a lot of class to the program. The program is spontaneous. We have guest stars, and we pass among the people and talk to people. Just before we went on the air, we warmed the audience over. You allowed to end a sentence with a preposition? We warmed the audience up. That's much worse. And we're going to talk to a few people. First of all, I said before that I liked your hat, and I'm very serious. I do. It's very pretty. Who are you?
I'm Mrs. Marty from Salt Lake City.
Salt Lake City, Utah. Mm-hmm. I told you that right. I come from a suburb of Salt Lake City.
Yes.
Syracuse, New York.
That's our suburb.
Well, it's a pretty far removed suburb, but... And what are you laughing at?
Nothing.
That's true. That's probably the most apt critique of the show I've ever heard. Who are you?
Margot Monroe.
Margot Monroe?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very charming name. It sounds, I may be absolutely wrong on this, but it sounds slightly like a theatrical name. Are you in the theater?
No.
You'll have to get in line not to be in the theater. A few more shows like this and I won't be in radio. It would be funnier if I were kidding. Are you from UCLA?
No, I'm not.
You're very pretty.
Thank you.
So are you.
I should have an ad-lib for that, but I don't know. Thank you very much. The reason I asked if you were from UCLA, as I said, I'm a stranger here. Sounds like a title for a motion picture. I'm a stranger here. And I was walking down, what is this place, Sunset Boulevard? thank you, Max. Sunset Boulevard, and, no, a very pretty girl walked by with one of these college sweaters on, and, you know, trying to meet people. I walked over and I said, have a cigarette? She said, I beg your pardon, I'm a UCLA girl. I said, I'm sorry, have a cigar. I understand you, young lady, work for a rival network.
Yes, I did.
I like the way you pass that tense. You work for, name escapes me at the moment.
NBC.
Sacrilege. What did you do at NBC? As a matter of fact, what does anybody do at NBC?
That's a good question.
I'm glad you said that, too.
Yes, I worked as the secretary to the directors in the television division.
In the television division?
Yes.
I see. And now you're not working there anymore.
No, I'm not.
Would it be corny if I said it was the wisest move you ever made? Well, yeah, I guess it would. You moved.
I don't know all the answers.
No, I don't, honey. I don't even know any of the questions. You moved from the NBC television outfit, huh?
Yes, I did.
Having seen some of the television directors, and you're a secretary, as I said, it's a good idea to keep moving. As a matter of fact, looking at this audience, I think I'd better begin moving. No, every once in a while you look at an audience and they look like they're going to form a posse and come up and get you. Stranger things have happened. Let's walk down among the audience. Again, is that correct English? Do you walk down among an audience? You know, I'm used to reading tea leaves when I pass among people, so if I suddenly say that you were from Flushing, Long Island, and you're about 64 years old, right?
About that.
Really?
Really.
May I tell you something? I'm always being kidded about having horn-rimmed glasses, you know. I wonder if you've ever been kidded about the fact that your hair is beginning to recede a little.
Oh, I've been kidded more than once about that. But that's all right. A little kidding makes one feel good.
Voltaire.
Yes, makes one feel good.
No, I figured maybe that expression was from Voltaire. Oh, no. You're from Flushing, Long Island.
Flushing, Long Island.
That's on Long Island.
Oh, naturally.
Brilliant dialogue like this you get on no other program, I might add. I was going to say about the hair thing, I wouldn't worry about it because... Oh, you're an artist, too. Don Least, we've mentioned every other network, I guess, except CBS. What is this Don Lee station?
Well, she's an attendant there. I drew her there.
She's an attendant? What does she do, park cars? She gave you tickets? I've had the same trouble with the cops on Sunset Boulevard.
Well, this fellow over here plays in Hollywood parts.
He plays in Hollywood parts, I see. I was going to say about your hair, sir, I wouldn't worry about it because, no. Really, I have perfected a brand new thing. It doesn't grow hair, but it shrinks your head to fit whatever hair you have left.
I need a little shrink at your head.
No, I'm glad about the kidding about the horn-rimmed glasses, though, because if you've noticed, there's a whole new type of matinee idol. Russell Knipp, I think, is a prime example of it. He's a guy with horn-rimmed glasses and the crew cut. Big new thing. The guy in Chicago, Dave Garraway, I'm sorry. Garraway, Dave Garraway. Perfectly normal mistake. Dave Garraway, he does the horn-rimmed glasses thing in Robert Q. Lewis in New York. Well, it's a good idea. Ladies and gentlemen, we have guests scattered among you. Turn around and who knows, you may bump into Lana. Not Lana Turner, Lana Schwartz. She's an old friend of mine. I figured we'd have a drop-in. Back in the rear of the room, having heard the show in New York, that's the wisest move he ever made. He stays far away from it. Is a guy who is an orchestra leader, a raconteur. Would you repeat what? Raconteur, that's from the French, meaning no smoking. A television star out here and a real wonderful all-around guy. What's his name? Frank Duvall. Ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome for Mr. Frank Duvall. Mr. Duvall, if you'll seat yourself at yonder microphone.
I feel like time for a beanie with this option.
We have arranged a table and a microphone right at the head of the stage in front of the audience, going by the old show business axiom that if you're going to talk to people, let them come and get you. Blues.
I'm the stationary one in this moving
First of all, let's get rid of the usual formalities. You're an orchestra leader.
Yes, yeah, I guess I am. I don't know. I'm trying to get rid of that now. But I...
Really? Why?
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to be an actor now.
You want to be an actor?
I got a few laps with a pair of big shoes, and now I'm off to the races.
That's peculiar to your whole species of orchestra leaders. I mean, the big shoes thing.
Yeah, well, that's right, I guess.
I like your tie.
Thank you.
Is
one
there
of
a...
my wife's old belts. No, it's the Western influence, you know. I think Walter O'Keefe, who has a show of sorts around here, has started manufacturing these ties, and I lost a bet, and I have to help him out, I guess.
It's sort of an off-the-shoulder tie.
Yeah. It's not quite as off as yours, but it's...
Frank, I understand that you like foreign cars.
Well, I do, yes.
In fact, you own one.
Yeah, I've had one now for about 5 years.
And it's, what do they call them, Triumphs?
Yeah, it's not too well known out here. I think there are only a half a dozen out here. Phil Harris has one. And,
name dropper.
Yeah, I know that. Well, this is a closed circuit. What do you want?
All right, well, let's drop a few circuits then. Phil Harris has one?
Yeah, I don't know who else. Some doctor at Catalina and three other guys from Pomona.
From Pomona. Yeah. Probably a double play combination for the Cleveland Indians. I was going to ask you, you mentioned Phil Harris. Now he'll know I'm in town. I haven't called him.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. This is what is known as being a name dropper, too.
I see. Do you know Alice?
Alice who?
Alice Schwartz. There's no relation.
Go out and live with an orchestra leader. You're busy doing TV out here.
Yeah, we have a show every Sunday on a rival network. Well, rival, I should say. It's not a network, so it's a local station. But we have a lot of fun on it. It's called KTLA, as long as we only have about 90 people here that are going to spoil things for CBS.
Have we got 90 people here?
Well, I'm counting my wife back there and Joel Preston and a friend.
Oh, all right. 90 people.
But we're on every Sunday night for Acme Beer, 9 o'clock. I don't know how many people have seen it. You see, it's a great show.
Well, no, it could be that people just don't like to raise their hands this late in the day.
Well, some people don't have television sets, you know.
Talking about not having television sets, I must tell you a story. You say, why don't you, Bill?
Why don't you, Bill?
All right, I will. I must tell you a story about a friend of mine who owned a bar over here on... I'm trying to make this local, so I don't know some of the... Yeah. La Cienega Boulevard?
That's good.
Mm-hmm. Good. On La Cienega Boulevard, and this guy couldn't afford a television set. He was losing all of his bar business because people like to go into bars and watch TV now. And finally, about 3 weeks ago, he had a big sign out, big unveiling tonight, brand new television set. And we all knew he couldn't afford one, so we gathered around that night wondering what he'd come up with. At about 9 o'clock that night, everybody standing at the bar... Back of the bar has got this big canvas covering what we imagine to be the television set. Promptly at 9 o'clock, pull the canvas aside. Wasn't really a television set, but he had a big orange crate with a plate glass window, and inside he had two midgets with wrestling trunks. Pretty ridiculous, huh?
Yeah.
So is the story.
I like it. I thought you were going to tell the... I thought you were going to tell about...
No,
the...
I wasn't.
No, well, that's... it wouldn't have gone anyway.
No, I didn't see that. No. Got to stay in the business, huh?
Yeah. How do you like it out here, besides after being in the Embers? Weren't things so hot there or what?
Well, the Embers, I must explain, was a nightclub in New York City. And I worked out of there. And I think
Yeah, you worked your way out, clear out to here.
I sure did. No, as a matter of fact, I came to California with innumerable requests, mostly from the people in New York, to get out of here. I had heard so much about L.A. and its environs, about the fact that there are nothing out here but beautiful women and sunshine. That, mm-hmm. for example, if you want a grape, you pick it off a vine. You want an orange, you pick it off a tree. Pick it off what?
Hollywood and Vine.
Yeah. Or if you want a tomato, you call her up. Loused up the gag.
Huh? I'm sorry.
Well.
But you know, you won't have... The food out here is, if I may say this at the risk of... being a bad guy.
Yeah.
It's not quite as good as it is in New York, and especially at the Embers. I know you're through there, but I can tell you this frankly now that I had wonderful food there.
I didn't want to tell you, but one of the guys listening up in the closed circuit room...
Yeah?
Owns the Encore.
Owns the Encore?
A restaurant here.
Oh, I see. That's where you're going? Right after this?
Well?
For dinner, that is.
No, right after this, I'm thinking seriously of packing my grip and going to, where is it, San Fernando?
Well, that's where I live. If you meant stay with me, that's out. I have two children, that's
no, all. No, that's all right, Frank. I understand. Anybody in the audience want to ask Mr. Duvall any questions? Ask him anything except something like, what do you think of the Iranian situation? Or why don't you shut up?
If they do that, I'll have to go into a buried grave. Of course, they know nothing about that.
Questions like that we can't take. But anybody got any questions they'd like to ask an orchestra leader? Well, just a second, sir. Wait till we give you the microphone. Who are you?
Leo Schultz of Hollywood. I'd like to know if Mr. Duvall is going to open up with Dinah Shaw and Margaret fighting in September.
We're going to start on the Jack Smith, Dinah Shaw, Ginny Sims show. August 27th, Miss Sims has taken the place of Margaret Whiting, who decided she wanted to do theaters and personal appearances.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Sounds a little like the town hall meeting of the year. Really?
Well, any information, you know.
Anybody else got any questions? I have a few questions I'd like to ask him, but I can't ask him on the air. All right, Mr. Duvall, I want you to know that it's been a pleasure having you. And man and boy, I've seen you grow up as an orchestra leader.
Well, that's wonderful, and I certainly hope we see you out here for many years, Mr. Allen.
Frank Duvall, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks, Frank. Wonderful guy. Real wonderful guy. Usually at this part in any particular program, they have a sponsor, but, I won't hesitate about it. We just plain don't have any sponsors. What are you going to do? Things like that happen. I will tell you, though, that if you've listened to radio, if you've got the courage and the inclination, I'd like to do something for you, which they do in radio, usually on a sponsored show. I'm sure a lot of you listen to private detectives on radio. Have you heard Private Eyes on the air?
I've heard some of them.
Who's your favorite private eye?
Oh, let's see. Sam Spade?
Martin. Sam Spade and Martin Kane. They go as an entry. Sam usually goes with blinkers on, but, as long as you've listened to them, if you don't mind, I have listened to them very carefully, and I've noticed that all of those guys usually talk in analogies, and they're usually kind of hard, so that a typical program might run something like this. We could use a background music, but we don't have it, so we'll just do it without the background music, which is kind of clever, I suppose. I don't know. The private eye usually comes on. The guy says, we like to present Bulldog Drummond's brother, Cocker Spaniel. Am I kind of ragged, baby? There are just two kinds of people, dead and alive. Am I kind of ragged? It doesn't pay to ask questions. Of course, this makes it kind of tough to find out anything, but just the other day, I was talking to my friend, the fire commissioner. I said, what do you say, commish? He says, no smoking. That's why I like to call this case, gentlemen who prefer blondes never live to regret it. This particular case opens when I'm pulling down Sunset Strip in my convertible with a coat collar turned up, and the rain is coming down like rain. I was wetted in the audience in a Margaret O'Brien movie. Little beads of perspiration stood out on my forehead, so I picked them off, strung them, and put them in my pocket. Ava loved beads. Too bad she was dead. I pull up to this beautiful mansion in the Hollywood Hills, and as I walk, my footsteps on the gravel sound like Baron Leone walking through a bowl of Rice Krispies. There's a dog lying out in front, and he growls at me like I'm an umpire and he's Leo DeRocha. I look at the dog. It is Leo DeRocha. Only smaller. I go inside, and it's dark and creepy. I feel like a guy about to go in a tunnel of love with his mother-in-law. It's then that I notice a spot on the rug. And just to show you the way a private eye can really deduce things real smart-like, upon real close inspection, I discover that the spot on the rug is a guy's body. He's got 10 bullet holes in his think conk, a rope around his neck, a dagger in his back, and he smells of prussic acid. He's dead. And that's why I'd like to tell you how I ended the case, but it so happened that I ended the case ending a case, so I couldn't sober up in time. But I will leave you with this thought from Voltaire that people in glass houses should never throw parties. I think that's what he said. That's the way private eyes function, for better or worse. This microphone is very interesting, isn't it? Yes, it is. We have a galaxy of luminaries. You allowed to say that on the air? Yeah, I guess you are. A galaxy of luminaries here in the audience. First of all, you, sir. Who are you?
Mr. Ellsworth from Paris, France.
Are you really from Paris, France? My hometown. Well, again, a pretty far removed suburb, but what can you do? Are you're here in the States? How long?
3 years.
3 years. What did you do in Paris?
Kansas City, Missouri.
That's a good town to come from. No, who was the first to describe Kansas City as a far-flung city, but they didn't fling it far enough?
I don't know. Who was?
Somebody from Minneapolis.
Sounds good.
Sounds good? Kansas City, you have a slight southern accent, too.
Well, I can't help it.
All right.
You all.
You all. I love the cowlick in you. You have the same thing that I have, except mine goes right down to my nose. The cowlick, I mean. Cowlick, that's an old French expression meaning cowlick. It's something to do with your head. I don't know what it means, but you're supposed to throw things like this in. It makes the program warm. As I was saying, comedy writers are a much unappreciated group. We have such a gentleman in our crowd today, and possibly after his appearance, he'll be even more unappreciated. This guy writes a program for CBS. Thank goodness we finally got somebody on CBS. A program called My Friend Irma, and I'm sure if you give him a wondrous welcome, not yet, a wondrous welcome, he may wend his way microphoneward and, spout many gems of comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, from the My Friend Irma show, Mr. Stanley Adams. Mr. Adams. Mr. Adams, looks a little in his clothes and get up like Lee Cobb.
Well, thank you. I've been told I look like Vincent Price.
You've been told you look like whom?
Well, my mother keeps telling me I look like Vincent Price. Vincent Price, the actor.
What does Mr. Price keep telling you look like?
I look like
I know how you feel. Is it true that most comedy writers have a serious vein and that they would really love to turn out drama?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did start writing by writing suspense. My first two shows were suspense shows. This is about 9 years ago.
Really?
Back in New York, yes.
I didn't know that.
Well, thank you.
No, I've known you for so long, I never knew that you delved into the drama.
Well, I kind of like it. It's a lot of fun writing the drama, because you don't have to go for a joke every other line, you know?
What do you do when you're writing comedy and you sit at your typewriter and nothing comes forth funny?
You kill yourself.
No, seriously, it must be a tremendous problem to week after week realize that you have to turn out a half-hour show which will be heard by countless millions, and which is supposedly a very funny show, and it is, really, sincerely.
Well, thank you.
How do you turn it out when
well,
nothing
actually,
comes forth?
Well, actually, Bill, when you write a show like Irma, the characters are so defined, each one of them, that it isn't hard to picture in words what they would say or react to in a given situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like Al, you know, the con man, the phony, you know exactly what he's going to do when somebody comes up to him and says, hey, you got $10. You know?
No, nobody's ever come up and asked me for $10. They know my work.
Well, perhaps this isn't the right analogy, but when you define characters, this is the basic important thing in the script, is get your characters so well-defined that you know exactly how they're going to react to a situation, and then it's real tough. That's when the work comes in.
Have you ever wanted to become a comedian yourself? I've seen you work at private parties. That sounds kind of ridiculous. I've seen you work at private parties, and you're a very funny guy. And most comedy writers When they get away from their typewriter or from turning out comedy, are usually kind of sour and, as a matter of fact, kind of sullen people. They aren't about to let loose with comedy unless they get paid for it. But you're a tremendous extrovert and a great performer.
Say,
I don't know what I said again, but again, it adds dignity to the program.
Well, actually, I think most comedy writers, it's sort of a big frustration with them, you know, because if you can't be a comedian, you associate yourself with them, you write for them. Everything you write, you'd like to say yourself. But unfortunately, few of us have the potential to be a comedian or a comic.
Uh-huh. Before I... Something just struck me.
Yeah.
Don't leave the room.
Uh-huh.
Remember we had Frank Duvall? He's sitting in the control room now. We had Frank Duvall on the program. I want to show you, I talked about Frank's melodic genius and his wonderful way with music. I just want to prove to you that this guy is a tremendous musician. We have a piano over here. And I'm gonna play something, and Frank will show you exactly his background and how well-versed he is with music. Frank, you listening? All right. Let me get over the piano here. I used to play piano, but I played in a small nightclub in New York. About 4 o'clock one morning, the reason I quit, about 4 o'clock one morning, we caught a guy stealing into the club. We figured it was a burglar, but it was Mr. Steinway coming in to scratch his name off the piano, so... Now, Mr. Duvall, listening? All right. Now, listen. Now, this is what amazes me about this guy. What opera is that from?
Aida.
You're right. See? Brilliant. Aida, he knew. What were you asking me?
Well, I thought that was very interesting. I'm going to write. Do you mind if I use that in one of our shows, Frank?
Sure. Incidentally, copies of Mr. Duvall's address may be had by writing to the station.
I would rather you'd use me in one of your shows.
Oh, I understand that Frank makes nothing but loot out here. And well, after... Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, Frank's a very fine performer. As a matter of fact, I've seen you a great deal, Frank, and I've always liked your performance, especially on Pantomime Quiz. You remember Frank on Pantomime Quiz, anybody? Great, wasn't it? Real great.
Don't coax my audience.
Of course, there was another guy by the name of Hans Conried.
Who was Vincent Price, which is what you're leading up to.
That's right. Vincent was wonderful. As far as Frank's work, as I said, he makes a lot of money, but I think it was you who first told me this, that money doesn't mean anything, that money can't buy you health or happiness.
Of course not. Money is... It's ridiculous.
We're talking about Confederate money.
Yeah.
Stan,
yeah.
Tell you what I'm going to do, just to show you how much I appreciate your coming on the show. Usually, they give the guest a prize.
A Whitnow watch or something.
No, we couldn't afford a Whitnow watch exactly, but we have backstage a 5-pound box of mustache wax.
Oh,
now, this sounds kind of stupid, doesn't it? But you'll never know, 5 o'clock some morning, somebody will call you up and say, Stan, I need 5 pounds of mustache wax, and there you are.
That happened yesterday.
Who was the guy who called you?
Mr. Paley, I think it was.
Mr. whom?
Mr. Paley, CBS.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Paley, yeah. Send him the mustache wax. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks, Stan. Stanley Adams of My Friend Irma fame. I'm getting the nod from our director. Do you think we ought to wind it up? 5 more minutes? All right, we got 5 more minutes. Anybody got anything interesting they want to beef about or something? You have. You're hungry? So's this show, hon. What would you like to eat?
Chicken. Fried chicken.
You've come to the right program. Funny you should mention fried chicken because I've also appeared on radio under the name of the Mystery Chef. How do you make fried chicken?
You put it in a frying pan and fry it. You know, turn the gas on.
You put it in the frying pan and fry it?
Well, how do you make fried chicken in Syracuse? That's how we make it in Rochester.
Are you from Rochester?
Yeah.
My hometown.
My hometown, too.
Well, I don't know how they made fried chicken in Syracuse because I was a college man myself, and I don't remember that we ever had fried chicken. Being a college man, you know, we had nothing but old professors and so forth. I'd like you to know, incidentally, in winding up this program that I didn't do this program for nothing. As a matter of fact, we already have made out the check for me this afternoon. You know, when you go into the accounting department at any, whether it's a radio outfit or any business concern, you go in the accounting department, they always take something out for withholding tax, for pension fund, for the laundress, and, you know, stuff like that. Well, it ended up with everything taken out. They gave me a check here at CBS for one penny. Seriously, a check was made out to Bill Williams for one penny. And I was kind of ill at ease when I went across the street to the Bank of America, but I took it in. I did. I took it in, and I handed it to the teller. I figured I'd get some sort of wisecrack from him, but nothing. He took it very matter-of-factly, and all he said was, how'll you have it, heads or tails? That's silly. What's new with you?
Nothing. I'm on my way home.
You're on your way home?
Uh-huh.
And you stopped in?
Mm-hmm. Stopped in.
Glad you did.
I'm glad, too.
Why?
Well, I like...
This is what is known as fishing for a compliment.
Well, I just wanted to see a show.
Oh. You hadn't heard that I was going to be in town.
No, I hadn't heard.
You'll have to get in line not to have heard it because nobody has.
Oh.
Where do you live?
Kansas City.
And you just stopped in?
I'm on my way home.
This'll do it. You've heard, I'm sure you've heard the old story about the three producers, the Hollywood producers, who have their limousine chauffeur-driven car driven up to their home in Beverly Hills, and the three of them decide they're going to go to New York. And as they start to get in, one gets behind the wheel, and the other two are deciding how to sit. One guy says, well, I'd better sit on the outside because I'm getting off at 50th Street and Broadway. That's a ridiculous story. In retelling, it loses a lot of its flavor. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been, for better or worse, richer or poorer. I now pronounce you man of microphone, the Bill Williams Show. We had interviews and we passed amongst the people. Anybody here before we go has something tremendously interesting to say? Because Lord knows I haven't. You're supposed to end the program with a brilliant philosophical dissertation. I'd like to leave you with a brilliant thought. Well, man, I can't think of any. That guy in the control room looks like Gil Lamb. Oh, he's a guide here. And how about a good joke? Not on this program. No. Thank you very much for being a very wonderful audience and bearing with me. And don't leave yet. After the program, I'll tell you what happens. Well, no, I guess I've been in that. Thank you very much for being a very wonderful audience. This has been a closed-circuit audition. We hope you've liked it. We hope particularly that you've liked our guests who've been most magnanimous in appearing on the show. I love the way this kid flings words around. Magnanimous. That's from the old Latin. Most magnanimous in appearing. If we ever go on the air, I wish you'd come back because you're the type of audience that's much easier to work to than dead people. You are. We would like to thank our orchestra for not appearing on the show. The gentleman in the control room with the brilliantly colored, multicolored shirt is our director. His name is Dave Vail. After this show, he probably figures he better be directing traffic. No, he directed the show, and do we have anybody? We had Frank DeVore and Stanley Adams. We would like to thank the guide who looks like Gil Lamb. In fact, we'd like to thank Gil Lamb. We had just before we go off, final closing thing, I had a telegram just before I went on this thing from Lana Turner. Would you repeat that?
I didn't...
Oh, somebody whistled.
Back there.
Sir. We had a telegram from Lana Turner, and she assured us that if she's within 50 miles of this program, it'll be a complete surprise to her because she intends to stay completely away from it. But who knows? Again, many thanks. My name is Williams, and we'll see you again soon. Thank you.
An audition recording of The Bill Williams Show from August 16th, 1951, from CBS affiliate KNX, on Tuned to Yesterday. A couple of years earlier, Williams was given the chance to host this type of program out of Mutual Broadcasting System station WOR in New York City. In 1949, Billboard magazine wrote that, quote, Bill Williams, announcer turned comic, not only handles the comedy chores, but writes all his material as well. This seems too much of an assignment. But the true assignment Bill took on as William B. Williams proved to be the most lucrative, as when he returned to the East Coast to work once again with WNEW, he was handed the reins of one of the station's most popular and enduring music shows known nationally, called the Make Believe Ballroom. And from there, Williams became one of the most revered voices on radio, lauded for his musical knowledge and his warm and down-to-earth delivery. While digging through the archives for more from Williams, I also found a recording that wasn't meant for broadcast of a Friars Club roast that he was on, honoring or tearing apart comedian Don Rickles.
There are a few words from William B. Williams from the old medium, radio. William B. Williams.
Thank you, Jack.
Oh, that's all right.
Donald, first of all, I am always amazed at the selection of the person to be honored at these stag luncheons. Another triumph in the selection of Mr. Rickles, who has all of the charm, all of the warmth of an unflushed toilet.
And if you know anything about the Friars Club roasts, that is all I can air, that recording from 1967. William B. Williams also has the distinction of having a room named after him at the famous Friars Club in New York and as one of the many on-air legends in the Radio Hall of Fame. This is an hour of collection curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark LeVonier. Now on to a broadcast of Tales of the Diamond K, featuring Western Screen star Ken Maynard. The short-lived syndicated series was produced in 1951, about 6 years after his retirement from motion pictures that usually had him starring as himself. At this time, he was working for the Cole Brothers Clyde Beatty Circus, using his film fame to carry him through after his movie work dried up. This also marks the only real radio series he was ever on, normally only heard on the air in brief interviews. This is the 17th broadcast in the series from 1951, called The Devil's Kitchen.
How you doing there, folks? This is Ken Maynard with another tale from the Diamond K. You know, it's mighty nice having you drop in and visit with us every day here in the tack room of the Diamond K Ranch. Tarzan would like to say hello, too, wouldn't you, boy? You know, that's his way of inviting you to visit with us for the next 15 minutes. I've got a story to tell you called Devil's Kitchen. So pull up your chair and make yourself comfortable.
From the tack room of Ken Maynard's Diamond K Ranch, we're bringing you stories of adventure. Stories of circus life, fascinating transcribed tales of the Old West, where cowboys still follow the cattle trails. Stories of rodeos and parades, colorful legends, hidden gold and buried treasure. The exciting tales from the Diamond K are told by Hollywood's champion of Western stars, internationally famous Ken Maynard. And Ken's got a real thriller in store for you today, buckaroos. And speaking of thrills, just imagine Ken coming right into your living room and saying hello to you personally. Say, isn't that a thrill? And that's not all, no, sir. After Ken speaks to you directly, he'll tell you two of his favorite stories about the Wild West. Now, I'm talking about the Ken Maynard personalized record album that you can have for your very own. Now, you can't buy it in any store. No, sir. This is Ken's own Diamond K brand record album. It's all in color with a big picture of Ken and Tarzan right on the front. And inside are two big 8-inch unbreakable phonograph records made of expensive pure vinylite. Ken and Tarzan's picture is right on the record, too, and there's another picture on the back of the album. Now, here's the best part of all. When you put the record on your phonograph, you'll hear Ken talking right to you with a personalized message. He'll say,
now, hello, Andy. Hello, Betty.
Or whatever your name is. Here's all you do. Just put a dollar bill and your name and address in an envelope and send it to Records in care of this station. Isn't that amazing? You get two wonderful records with two real Western stories all in a beautiful colored album for only $1. Send in right now, kids, and just wait till you see how surprised your friends will be when you play the record and Ken speaks right to you personally. Be the first in your neighborhood to own a real Ken Maynard personalized record album. Now, Ken.
One afternoon, about a month ago, I had a couple of young visitors here on the ranch. They came out from the city to spend the day. Tommy Barton and his younger brother, Bob. Well, sir, they followed me around the ranch as I did a few odd jobs, and along about sundown, we fed Tarzan and bedded him down for the night. I'll tell you, these boys could ask more questions than the quiz show. You got to be right on your toes to keep ahead of youngsters nowadays. Well, after we finished the chores and fed the dogs, old Pepper and Lucky, we went back to the tack room, lit the fire, and settled down for some storytelling. Tommy said to me, "Ken, we don't want to hear any sissy stories." I looked over at the youngsters curled up on the big Navajo rug in front of the fire and said, "Well, what kind of a story do you want to hear, Tommy?" "Well, we want something that's got a lot of excitement and adventure," he answered eagerly. Well, I could see just an ordinary yarn about cowboys wasn't going to satisfy this young man, so I picked up a map lying on my desk and pointed to a dot in the southeast corner of Arizona and said, "Can you read that, Tommy?" He looked at me kind of disgusted-like and said, "Sure I can. That's Tombstone, Arizona." He settled back on the rug and I asked, "How would you boys like to hear a true story about one of the toughest gang of robbers that ever toted a six-gun?" Well, sir, their eyes lit up like a prairie fire, and before they could ask more questions, I started my story. Curly Bill Brocious was the leader of this gang of robbers, and a mean hombre if ever I saw one. Curly had a face like a bulldog and a voice to match. It was one night just after supper. Curly Bill and his gang were sitting around their fire in a hill somewhere east of Tombstone as he said to them, "There's a 17-mule train coming over the border from Mexico, heading for Tucson with a load of smuggled gold. It's worth close to $3 million. There's only one hitch. I don't know when they're leaving Mexico or how many men will be guarding the train. We only got 6 men, and they probably got 10, maybe 20. But that's not going to stop me from getting that $3 million in gold," Curly said, "because I've got an idea. But we'll have to work fast." Well, sir, Curly Bill did have an idea, all right. He sent one of his men, an old cutthroat by the name of Hughes, down to Mexico. Kept his ears open, found out the information he wanted, then hightailed it back to Curly Bill's hideout. When Hughes walked in, one of the toughest men of the gang, Zwing Hunt, was sitting in the cabin digging his spurs in the tabletop. Hughes looked at Zwing in surprise as he sat there acting like he was boss. "Where's Curly?" Hughes asked. Zwing's lips twisted in a half smile as he said, "Hello, Hughes. Curly's got something stewing over around Tombstone. Didn't say when he'd be back." Then Zwing pointed to a chair and he said, "Sit down, Hughes. You look kind of nervous. Must have learned a lot of things down in Mexico, huh? Let's you and me talk it over while we're waiting for Curly Bill." Well, sir, Hughes thought about that for a minute. He was supposed to report to Curly Bill. Zwing was a sort of a second in line, and there wasn't any time to lose. The mule train with the gold was already on its way. Zwing started asking casual questions, and before Hughes had really made up his mind to talk, he told Zwing the whole story. Well, before the evening was over, the 2 men had decided to give Curly Bill a double cross and handle the job themselves. They lined up a couple of the boys they thought they could trust and set out along about sunup to ambush the smuggler's train. After days of hard riding, they picked their spot in Skeleton Canyon right near Devil's Kitchen. It was a long, narrow canyon with plenty of boulders and patches of brush. A mighty good hideout for them. Zwing Hunt and Hughes hid their men and horses back in the shadows of the rocks and started the long wait for the first sight of the mule train. It was early evening on the second day when Zwing and Hughes heard the clinking of chains and saw the mule train as it started its slow, tedious climb up the narrow box canyon. Zwing's voice was tense as he whispered, "There she comes, Hughes. Must be at least 30 mules and 15 or more men. We'll get them in the narrows and then pick them off one by one." Well, sir, the walls of Skeleton Canyon echoed like thunder on a sultry day. I reckon you could hear the cries and shouts of the Mexicans from miles around. They were trapped, caught in the narrows with the entire mule train. They couldn't turn around. There wasn't room. They had to go forward or desert the treasure-laden mules. And Zwing, Hughes, and their few men were placed so they could shoot the smugglers like flies. In desperation, the Mexican smugglers stampeded the mules, and they came roaring down the Devil's Kitchen like angry bulls as the sacks on their backs ripped against the rocks, scattering their contents like tumbleweeds in the wind. Whew! Well, telling this story sure gets me excited even. While we rest just a minute, let me interrupt the story to tell you about something I'm mighty proud of. Have you heard about my K-shirt? It's a real Western shirt that a friend of mine designed especially for me. It's sort of like a T-shirt, you know, nice cotton about the color of desert sand, with a flaming red Diamond K brand centered on the front. And it's got our picture on it, too, me and Tarzan. Well, the kids in my neighborhood took a fancy to it and wanted one like it, so my friend made up some special. Kid said I ought to tell you about them, so that's what I'm doing. If you figure you'd like to have a K-shirt like I wear when I'm practicing tricks and fooling around, I'll see that you get one if you drop me a note. Fella said he'd fix you up with only a dollar apiece. That sure surprised me. Just name your size, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, or 12. If you want a K-shirt like mine, just send me your name and address and the size, and slip a dollar bill in the envelope, too, and send it to K-shirt in care of this station. Well, now let's get back to the Gold of Devil's Kitchen. Young Tommy and his brother were sitting up on the floor of the back room, my ranch, with eyes as big as saucers as they both asked questions at once. What happened, Ken? What happened to the smugglers and the outlaws? And was there really gold on the mules? Well, in the confusion of the stampede, the few Mexicans that were left hightailed out of there like scared rabbits. Hughes and Zwing took after the escaping mules, shooting them down like a buffalo hunt. Even today, you can still see the bleached bones of the mules half buried there in the desert. Yes, sir, there was treasure, all right. The outlaws gathered the loot together in huge piles. There were statues of solid gold, boxes filled with diamonds, sacks of gold and silver coin, more treasure than they could possibly carry away on their ponies. So they decided to bury it and come back later. That same night, Hughes left for Galeyville to put Curly Bill off the trail, leaving the arrangements to Zwing. Now, I reckon that's where he made his mistake. No sooner had Hughes left than Zwing decided to give them all the double cross. Next morning, a few hours before sunup, he found a Mexican with a team and a wagon and hired him to haul the treasure to a new hiding place. As Zwing stood looking at the spot where the treasure now lay buried, the Mexican said, "You pay me now, then I go, huh?" Zwing smiled, his cunning eyes filled with greed. "Sure, I'll pay you," he said. "I'll pay you double." Well, sir, Zwing put his smoking guns back in their holster, and the Mexican lay dead in the desert sand. It was one night a couple of weeks later, Zwing was sitting in a saloon in Tombstone when the door swung open and Curly Bill Brocious stood framed against the night. He eyed Zwing and adjusted his guns and started to walk slowly toward the little man with the beady eyes. Curly Bill's lips were tritely drawn as his voice was hard, and he said, "Hello, Zwing. I've been looking for you. I heard rumors you've been kind of busy lately. Maybe you've been looking after my interests. Maybe you got something important to tell me, huh?" Zwing smiled. "Sure, I got something important to tell you, and it won't take long, either." Zwing was sneaking his gun out under the table as he talked. But Curly was too fast for him. He shot the gun out of Zwing's hand and then creased his shoulder. Curly didn't want to kill Zwing. He still had to find out where the gold was buried. Well, sir, they took Zwing to the hospital in Tombstone, and that's where his old friend Hughes caught up with him. When Zwing heard Hughes was in town, he ducked out of the hospital window, and that was the last anybody ever saw of him. Curly Bill's gang said Zwing was killed by the Indians, but an uncle down in San Antonio swears Zwing came to him wounded and badly infected. Zwing knew he was done for, so one night he called his uncle to the bed. His face was twisted with pain. Zwing asked his uncle to get a pencil and paper. It was hard for him to talk now. He said, "The money, $3 million. I've got to tell you where it's buried. I'll draw a map. See? In Arizona by the San Simon River. Stands a mountain, and between Silver Springs and Gum Springs is a burn wagon. Close by is a stone about hip high with two crosses on it. Then 20 paces east of the rock, under the burn wagon, is $3 million. $3 million. But Zwing Hunt never finished the sentence. Well, sir, Zwing's uncle spent the rest of his life looking for the treasure, but he never found it. He made one mistake. He took for granted that everyone knew where Davis Mountain was. He didn't realize that Zwing named the mountain after one of his dead outlaw pals who'd been killed in the ambush. The uncle found a burn wagon and a rock with two crosses on it, but nothing buried under it. So, folks, somewhere near Skeleton Canyon, there's still $3 million in treasure waiting for you, or you, or you, the lost gold of Devil's Kitchen.
Holy Toledo, Ken, that was a humdinger of a story. You know, I felt like I was really there during all the excitement, too. And say, kids, how would you like to have Ken really there, right in your living room anytime you want? Why, it's just like having Ken in person when you own one of his wonderful Diamond K record albums made especially for you. Remember what I told you earlier? You get a whole record album with two complete Ken Maynard Western stories in a beautiful bound album for only $1. Now, both the album and the records have colored pictures of Ken and Tarzan blazing right across the front. Don't forget,
These records are personalized with a message from Ken just for you. And he'll call you by name. They're high-quality records, too, made from pure vinylite, the finest material that money can buy. It's impossible to break one of these wonderful records, and you can play them over and over as many times as you want. So be sure to send in your name and address right now to Records in care of this station. Enclose a $1 bill. The records and the album will be sent right to you, postage prepaid from Hollywood. Hurry now. The quicker you write, the sooner you'll have your Western record album to hear and enjoy. Now, let's get back to Ken.
Well, folks, it's time to bring our story round up to a close. This is Ken Maynard and Tarzan. Closing up the tack room at the Diamond K Ranch till I see you next time, when I'll tell you the story of Secrets of Three Horn Ranch. We'll be looking for you. In the meantime, get your $1 bills in the mail now for some real Western fun. So long.
You've been listening to Tales from the Diamond K, stories of adventure told by Ken Maynard, internationally famous cowboy, stunt rider, and Hollywood's champion of Western stars. Tales from the Diamond K was produced and transcribed in Hollywood.
Tales from the Diamond K, on Tuned to Yesterday, that syndicated broadcast first heard in 1951. And that is it for this hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I hope you can be with us next time for more unique broadcasts and recordings from the era of radio's golden age. I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.